This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
If Encumbrance Was Fun.
Princess Caribou.
Installation Horror.
And Simon Foreman.
Robin? I just saw a tuxedo cat change into a red cape, then leap off the town hall clock tower. Have I been sniffing too much catnip?
You just saw a super kitty, Ken. We're not in River City anymore. Welcome to Meowtropolis, the brand new superhero setting for the Magical Kitties Save the Day RPG.
Super kitties? I thought magical was already pretty impressive. You're telling me these cats have secret identities now, too?
Precisely. In Meowtropolis, your kitty is a caped crusader, protecting the bustling city from diabolical supervillains. We're talking secret hideouts, origin stories, and power quirks that add the earth-shattering kaboom to your series.
Sounds like the stakes just got a whole lot higher. And the best part... The Meowtropolis Kickstarter is live right now.
We've got the Meowtropolis Hometown Book, the Trouble in River City Adventure Collection, and even a new solo puzzle book called Mice's Gambit.
This is obviously the one I've been waiting for, but Kickstarter campaigns don't last forever. We'd better pounce on those rewards before the clock runs out.
Head to atlas-games.com/backmeow. To get your super kitty supplements before they're gone. That's atlas-games.com/backmeow.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And the bag of dice, now hold on, it's two bags of dice. So that's two units, and then miniatures, that's a box of miniatures plus the starter kit of miniatures, so that's five units, and it's the party-sized bag of Doritos, so that's a unit and a half, and it's a quadruple album, so that's four. Robin, I don't know if we can fit into the gaming hut with all the stuff we have to get into the gaming hut to have the gaming hut. I feel like no game.
Oh, that's no fun. That's no fun at all.
Right. Because, Robin, I have just, in thrilling LARP fashion, acted out an encumbrance system. And that is the only fun anyone has ever had with an encumbrance system. Although, my beloved colleague Luke Crane has designed a game called Torchbearer, which is meant to be so unfun that the unfun becomes the fun. And it's all about encumbrance. So I guess leaving that special audience aside, how could encumbrance become fun for normal human gamers? Question mark.
Right. And for the subset of people who do think it's fun, I think the idea that it is unrealistic for people to be able to carry unlimited amounts of stuff makes total sense.
That's legit.
It's annoying when someone points out, you know, the halfling is carrying enough stuff to fit in a Volkswagen. What's up with that? And I think it is satisfying for the subset of people who are very interested in seeing a world modeled or just having the OCD satisfaction of knowing that things are in their proper places and are arranged properly and everything makes sense.
That you have one duffel bag of guns, not three duffel bags of guns.
Right. So there's a certain, you know, plot logic thing that you want to take care of. I think the idea of very complex encumbrance systems also comes from the desire to model something different about every slightly different set of armor. Uh-huh. So the fun of modeling things, which I think is something that doesn't happen in play, but it's somewhat satisfying. So also GMs sometimes like making their players suffer.
Surely not.
I believe... Last time I looked up the opposite of fun, but you could do a game where, you know, as in Torchbearer, where that becomes the gag, right? It's like how awful it is the point of the exercise and you're reverse reveling in how bad it is. But in general, outside of that rather narrow band of people who like playing games, this is something that is a thing that gives you permission to have fun. And as you suggest, the amount of unfun you have getting to have permission to be fun kind of cancels things out. But I thought, as a thought exercise, since we have about 15 minutes on our hands to talk about this, we could try and speculate about what would make an encumbrance system fun. Is there a way for that to be fun for everyone, or is that just always going to be a specialized issue? So you've mentioned the number one way to make it fun, which is to revel in the unfunness. Mm-hmm. What else can we do with the idea of, you know, people carrying stuff and making that part of the deal?
I mean, one of the sort of initial things that encumbrance also does is it gives the lightly armored characters a break. As you say, a lot of this grew out of making your armor weigh things, and that a plate mail guy and the leather armor guy should not, in theory, have the same number of moves and attacks. The plate mail guy should be weighed down by his plate mail. The leather guy should be able to bounce around. And I think that is where some of the fun comes, is by giving permission to play a under-armored or even non-armored, in old-school D&D, a magician-type guy, or maybe a druid, and play that. And that is the fun. Is the fun comes from ignoring the encumbrance system by not having to really use it for your armor. And that, I think, is still not a fun encumbrance system, but it is fun with an encumbrance system, which is maybe a quarter of the way to what we're asking. Making actual encumbrance fun, that seems like making actual bruising fun. It just fundamentally is not a fun activity to drag a bunch of stuff around. I think that making it a power so that you're a super strong, you know, Jack Reacher type guy. So yeah, you can carry three duffel bags full of guns because you're amazing. And so encumbrance becoming a superpower almost, instead of a accounting trick that everyone has to go through, maybe is a direction to point, he asked.
Right. So in that case, it's we're looking at bonuses that you get to either reflect that you're not wearing armor, or to reflect that you're wearing armor and it's not a problem for you, and you can carry a whole bunch of stuff as well. And the thing about bonuses is they are also not that exciting, because they happen in the character sheet phase. Mm-hmm. And then if you ever have to change up your bonus, that's annoying. You have to refigure all of your numbers and remember to tell the GM, oh, well, now I don't have my plus one because I'm carrying this thing, or I do have this extra plus one. That's still very fiddly. So a thing that is fun is when you succeed at something during play. And so perhaps you could have a sort of an encumbrance test, a thing that happens when you question, can you really carry all of this stuff? And there's a benefit of succeeding and there's a cost of failing. And so what if we made encumbrance, or something equivalent like carrying capacity, or you just still just call it strength, but you have strength tests, although I guess endurance is part of this as well, is that you make a roll, a strength roll or an endurance roll, in order to get through the desert with the extra chest of treasures. And so now there's suspense at the beginning. It's like, can you get this extra chest of stuff across the desert with all of the loot in it, or can you not? And do you want to increase your chance of success by leaving other things behind? And then you decide, what are the trade-offs of leaving things behind, so that it becomes a thing that is happening during the game, where you can be awesome or you can feel bad that things didn't work out for you properly. And therefore, it's part of the deal. And if you are the big strong guy, you can carry stuff. And if you succeed, people admire you. If you're the wizard, it was worth it for you to take that carrying capacity spell, because now you can create a little invisible platform to carry the loot across the desert and so forth, so that it becomes a thing happening in play rather than paperwork that annoys you if you ever think of it, or goodness forfend, have to adjust it.
Yeah, I think your sort of breakdown between in play and character sheet moments is a good one to think about, because there's nothing really wrong in the character sheet moment. You have your character, they have such and such an athletic score, such and such a strength or whatever it is. And when you're building out their sort of standard loadout, it's, you know, it's just more shopping, right? And everyone loves shopping. So you have only so much gold, so you have to buy certain kinds of boots. You only have so much carrying capacity, so you can only carry such a kind of weapon or wear such a kind of armor. That becomes a part of your loadout. And then, as you suggest with the finding the big box of treasure in the desert, then it becomes a challenge, and challenges in play are different from, and maybe it's just a matter of refiguring your carrying capacity now with all this treasure, or it becomes a specific sort of a go around the room. Everyone, you know, can carry umpty ump gold pieces worth of treasure without any extra problem, but this is how much more treasure there is. And do you want to do trade-offs? And that is the sort of, the GM is bribing you to be attacked by sand dwellers while you're going across the desert with half of your armor and none of your spare arrows because you left it all behind so you could get more sweet, sweet treasure in. And that becomes, as you suggest, a challenge to be overcome. And it can be an iterative challenge as you fight off the sand dwellers and now they've left their treasure behind. And now it's a question of, do we have time to sit around here and swap out treasure? Do we have more carrying capacity? Can we, you know, make the sand dweller prisoners carry the treasure at spear point? That means we can't sleep, but it does mean we get more treasure. And then it becomes an ongoing sort of a challenge. And that does become fun, although it's not so much an encumbrance system that's the challenge as an encumbrance adventure that is the fun, right?
Right. Well, I guess replacing a system with an adventure is is the fun, right? That's the answer, right? Is to lift it out of the realm of preparatory paperwork, because that creates all sorts of options for story. For example, now, you know, if you take the sand dwellers prisoner, you talk to them, you work out what it is, or you're combing through their treasure. You have to figure out whether that weird horn with all of the odd little flanges on it is worth carrying or is it just some sort of weird piece of junk. So that gives the sage something to do. And I guess also the thing about this is, like anything, you don't constantly do it.
Yeah.
That you have, you know, this is the adventure where we're going to care about carrying capacity. And that's part of the premise of the thing, is that, you know, we're sending you through the desert up into the redoubt of the Lich King, and we want you to get his life-size gold statue of himself, because, you know, we said Lich King, he's very egotistical, he has a very expensive statue.
And he can't look in mirrors, so he needs something to look at to remind himself what he looks like.
Of how handsome he was before he became a lich.
He's got a smear of cold command on the whole nine yards.
Right. And so that's part of the premise going in, is that, you know, you're tasked with not only fighting the Lich King, but then you have to get his very unwieldy yet extremely valuable treasure back to civilization. And so you're bought in also at the beginning that this is part of the premise. And so, again, unless your players are all masochists who enjoy comically suffering, which, you know, some games do work that way, they have that premise. But otherwise, you have to work hard, I think, to make this sort of logistical challenge fun and interesting. And therefore, you're sort of tipping the hat to an F20 trope, and then the next adventure you go back to not paying any attention to it and not caring, and, you know, hoping that you just forget the whole issue of that. Or, of course, another thing you as GM can do is make sure to give out only very portable treasures most of the time.
Right?
Yeah, it's like, oh good, more gems,
lots of gems and pearls
easy to transport.
And spices.
Right.
Yeah. And then I guess along the idea of making it the adventure, you can also make it like one room in the dungeon or one challenge on the adventure, so that the whole adventure is not caravan logistics, as much fun as that is. But you're going through the dungeon, and now there's the dungeon where everything weighs super a lot more because the magic gravity is increased. And so, do we leave stuff behind on this side of the dungeon? How do we cache it? What is most important to us to bring through? And that can become another challenge. And especially if you are making that decision under fire, because the balloon people are attacking you and they can float around despite the gravity because it's just lighter than air stuff. And so the balloon people are attacking you while you're deciding, what do we need to go into the gravity room and A, fight the balloon people with, and then B, go to the other side of the room because we've still got more dungeon to explore. And that becomes another sort of a challenge. And I think if you have a fairly simple and forgiving bookkeeping at the beginning for your encumbrance system, then doing it on the fly makes it easier rather than every single thing having, you know, weights down to the troy ounce. That becomes annoying. But if it's just a simple, you know, 1 point, 3 points, 5 points type thing that is pretty fast and easy to budget, it's fast and easy to do that either as an adventure or on the fly in a challenge. And I guess that sort of goes back to also what the encumbrance system should look like, is it should be very modular and very forgiving and very rough, as opposed to every single thing has to be weighed on jeweler's scales before you figure out if you can carry it or not.
Right. You could add a ticking clock to that, and that the gravity room that you have to leave a bunch of your stuff in, the longer it sits there, the heavier it gets. And after a while, it will become permanently heavier. So, you know, you don't need your repeating crossbow probably for the next encounter, so you leave it behind. But if you leave it too long, it will be too heavy to use again. And so you, that'll give you motivation, which is sort of reverse. It's like, don't let me get the encumbrance system out. Don't let me make your crossbow too heavy, right? That you want to avoid having a magic crossbow you can't use anymore.
I was just thinking that the balloon people would steal it, but that's good too. Either way.
Right. Well, the balloon people can't lift a crossbow, not even a regular one. You've clearly never dealt with balloon people. Well, on that note, let us balloon over to the next hut and see what waits therein. Ballad Hunters, the gumshoe game of folk songs going supernaturally wrong on the gritty side of the Regency era, is on Kickstarter until April 16th.
Britain, 1813.
Across the island, the folk ballads of the common people are coming to life.
The dead walk, dragons rise, lovers betray one another, authorities condemn innocents to die. Whatever happens in the song happens in real life.
In Ballad Hunters, you play amateur folklorists working as agents of the crown.
It's up to you, armed with a little ballad magic, to decipher the clues in each song and keep people alive long enough to change the ending.
Designed by Tristan Zimmerman, whose spin on Gumshoe was so brilliant and radical, we had to create a new line for it.
You arrive knowing something is wrong.
You hear someone sing the song.
Reality bends to its structure.
You find textual interpretations, then act on them.
The GM responds in the spirit of yes and.
The ending is never guaranteed.
Singing at the table is optional, but encouraged.
Group singing is a joy, and Ballad Hunters is a perfect excuse to sing a song with your friends.
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press.
Sing it, Ken!
Now on Kickstarter from Pelgrane Press.
The antiques that look real new, the clothing from the Regency period, some of which looks really fancy and others of which looks like maybe a servant is wearing it, or perhaps an intrepid ballad hunter's investigator who's more of a gritty working class type. Tell us that we're once more in the History Hut. And this time around, in honor of Ballad Hunters, which is now kickstarting from Pelgrane Press, we're going to look at a historical figure who appears in Ballad Hunters. And Ken, you're going to tell us all about Mary Baker. And then at the end, I'll let you know what she's up to in that game. So tell us about Mary Baker, or as she was more extravagantly known for a little while before people figured it out, Princess Caribou.
Princess Caribou. Well, the story of Princess Caribou, we normally begin with people's birth, but if the only fun thing that happened to them is 25 years after their birth, we're going to begin there. It's April 3rd, 1817, little town in Gloucestershire. A cobbler, on his way with a load of shoes to wherever cobblers go, sees a strange young woman. She's wearing weird clothes. She's babbling in an unknown language, and she's wandering around in a daze. And I don't think this happens every day in Gloucestershire, so the cobbler takes her back to his wife and says, I found this lady. I assume he does not say, can we keep her? But his wife says, you take her to the overseer of the poor. She's obviously a poor vagrant, lost her mind. So they take her there, and the overseer of the poor says, well, I don't really oversee lunatics. I just oversee poor people. I'm going to send her up to the county magistrate and he'll decide where she should go. So the county magistrate is a guy named Samuel Worrell, and he sort of interrogates her and she babbles nonsense at him. And so at one point they take her to a tavern and show her pictures to see if she can name things in a language that they recognize. She recognizes pineapples, but the word she uses is a nonsense word that isn't pineapple. And so he says, well, she must be a beggar. I'll just send her to Bristol and jail her for vagrancy. And that will take care of the problem.
Right. This is typical bureaucratic buck passing. Nobody wants to have to deal with this person, and they're all trying to get rid of her some way or another. And
right.
Imprisoning for vagrancy is the way to get rid of people then and now.
The way to solve things in 1817 anyway. But in prison, a Portuguese sailor named Manuel Enes says, oh, I recognize her language. She speaks Javasu, because she's from the island of Javasu, where I've been on my sailing trip, and her name is Caribou, and she's a princess of Javasu, and how dare you treat her this way? She was captured by pirates, but fortunately she escaped from the pirates and washed ashore from the Bristol Channel, and is depending on us for hospitality, and how dare you treat her that way? And by the way, we would both like to be let out of prison, please.
I was extremely lucky that she ran into someone who spoke Javanese. That wouldn't be that likely.
It was, frankly, an unbelievable coincidence, I would say. But there we are. So having discovered that she is royalty, she goes back to the Worrell's house, back to the magistrate's house, and they host her. And people come from all over Gloucestershire, I guess, and Bristol to see her. And she swims naked. She keeps talking her Javasu language. She practices archery and fencing. So clearly she's building up for some sort of adventure. Linguists come and decide that she is speaking a form of Javanese. And they, you know, pick out her language. And one of them says, oh, look, the designs on her neck are clearly tattoos from the Spice Islands. I think I've figured it out. I've seen this in books. I'm an expert. And she prays a couple of times a day to Allah Tala, is the name of her god. And it's great fun. But sadly, about 10 weeks after her triumphant unveiling, a lady named Mrs. Neal, who's a boarding house keeper, recognizes her picture from the paper and says, that's no princess. That's no good servant girl, Mary Wilcox. And she ran away. And that's what's going on. She should be in jail. And it turns out, yep, it was Mary Wilcox. And her language was a combination of Romani, because she had met the Roma when she was out wandering around. And also she made it up. So there we are. And the Worrells now are in the, well, now what do we do? If we send her to jail, that's going to be awkward. Maybe we should send her to Philadelphia, because Mrs. Worrell is an American and she has friends in Philadelphia. And she says they will be happy to have a princess in America. They don't have any princesses. They'd love that. And also, no one in America can send rumors back to England. So that'll be great.
Right. Also, people from Philly are loopy. So
right.
She'll fit right in.
It all works out. They speak a made up babble language as well.
She'll hang out with Gritty's ancestors.
Right. So off she goes to Philadelphia. One assumes she was not asked very strenuously, do you want to go to Philadelphia? But I think she was probably asked, do you want to go back to jail? And so the compromise is she goes to Philadelphia. And the best part of this whole story, I think, is that on her trip to Philadelphia, according to a newspaper story in the Bristol Journal, I believe, they say that she jumped ship at St. Helena and entranced Napoleon, and now he wants to marry her. And I think that Napoleon and Princess Caribou is the ship that should have happened. But as it was, that was a made-up story. She went nowhere near St. Helena. She goes to America, and sure enough, she says, I'm Princess Caribou, and everyone in America says, great. And goes on with their lives, which she doesn't much approve of. She goes to New York and tries to be Princess Caribou on the stage. And everyone says, is there a second act to this story? And she says, not really. And so in 1824, she goes back to England. She's sick of Americans and they are indifferent to her. She tries her Princess Caribou play on the London stage. By now, she's not even a sensation of the day, so no one cares about it there. In 1828, she marries a guy named Richard Baker. Bears him a daughter in 1829, and settles down to a fine middle-class career as a leech seller. She goes and finds leeches and sells them to a hospital. And I suppose she breeds them in whatever fen you breed a leech in, or a big tank. I don't know how it works, but maybe that's the secret, is you have to be a Javasoon princess to know how to breed leeches.
People will be upset if I tell them how you make leeches, so I won't.
All right. Anyway, she sells them to the hospital until her death in 1864, and that is the end of Princess Caribou Wilcox Baker, and that is her story. And it's a delightful story, especially because you get to make fun of a county magistrate, which is why everyone in England loved that story. And it's also delightful because it involves going to Philadelphia instead of jail, but just barely. So that's nice.
Right. And for a 6-week imposter, she's managed a nice little footnote for herself in the history books. In fact, there's even a movie about her from 1994 with Phoebe Cates in the title role. Today, when you hear her talked about by academics, it will be most likely through the lens of cultural appropriation, because what she was up to is somewhat reminiscent of the later phenomenon of the Pretendian, people who pretend to be indigenous. And there's a long history of that, with sometimes with a lot of fraud and sometimes just with a desire to adopt another identity. And in Ballot Hunters, though, that's set in 1813. That's before any of this. And in that setting, she is the messenger who delivers information back and forth between the investigators and their patron, Walter Scott, as they deal with the plague of folk songs coming to life. And so she shows up to provide exposition and to move the plot along. And in this version, she's already an expert in disguise and will show up in different guises, just sort of to be cool and to mess with you. And so one might think that in the alternate reality of Ballot Hunters, perhaps she never has to pose as Princess Caribou, or perhaps she poses more effectively, or maybe it is a song come to life that is going to cause this as some sort of after effect of the phenomenon. So perhaps you might want to look after her and save her from her somewhat ignominious downfall, and maybe find her a gig somewhat more exciting than leech sales.
Well, it's not just leech sales. It's a whole, you know, leech multi-level marketing system, actually. But we don't have time for that. Yeah, as I say, she has gigantic player character energy, which is, I think, why this story still sort of resonates. She's someone who said, you know what? I want to live in a nice house and have nice things, even if it's only for 10 weeks. It'll be better than I was ever going to get to do in my whole life. And all I have to do is gull a magistrate. And how hard can that be? Maybe I'll have to have a Portuguese sailor as my confederate. But I always wonder if that was set up, like she set this story up with the Portuguese guy and he was in Bristol jail already, or if it was just she shows up in the jail, looks around the cell, and rather than, you know, fighting the biggest guy in the yard, she finds the smartest Portuguese guy in the yard and says, hey, you want some pineapples? I know how we can get some pineapples. And a beautiful partnership is born. I feel like she has great energy, and it is kind of a shame that no one liked her play about being Princess Caribou, because I feel like, you know, it would be nice, as I said earlier, as I alluded, if she had a second act to her life. That would be fun.
Well, she may not have had a second act, but we have a third segment on the other side of this here commercial.
The play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tyne's famous clairvoyants divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Ensure that this podcast can keep moving with all its equipment by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Eric Lauren,
Evan Hughes,
Ian Nystrom,
Joshua Randall,
and Yuri Horniman.
The clanking of chains, the spooking of ghosts, the flutter of bats overhead, the lightning crashing through the sky. It's a good thing we have this large, terrifying structure to shelter in. Oh no, the large, terrifying structure is the horror hut. And within the horror hut, we are recursively discussing horror that happens in large, terrifying structures, or as it is sometimes called, installation horror. And Robin, to begin with, I guess, is this just a bigger word for haunted house, or are haunted houses a different thing than installation horror?
Yeah, so I thought we would focus on, obviously, every horror movie in some sense is in a confined space, is a version of the haunted house story, which is a version of the gothic. But I thought we would concentrate for the purpose of this segment on the specific subset of that that is a scientific facility or base or installation that is then threatened by a creature. And so just to orient ourselves, that's what we're talking about here. I think the modern origin of that comes from John W. Campbell's Who Goes There, which is more likely to be experienced these days in its movie forms as Thing from Another World from 1951, or John Carpenter's remake of that, The Thing from 1982. Or if they're a Doctor Who fan, this is your absolute bread and butter as a horror episode, in that Doctor Who combines science with horror elements. And starting in 1966 with an episode called The Tenth Planet, which was the handover from the first Doctor, William Hartnell, to the second Doctor, Patrick Troughton, and features the installation is a space monitoring station at the South Pole, and it is attacked by Cybermen, and it's the first appearance of the Cybermen, as well as the first appearance of the Second Doctor. And fans even have a term for this, which is not my term of installation horror, but it's the base under seed structure. And Doctor Who used that a lot for the Troughton era, and also later the Tom Baker era. And first of all, it's a great little structure that works so well that it works in role-playing as well, which we'll get to in a bit. But also for the purposes of that show, it's relatively cheap to produce because you've only got a certain number of sets. You can have them all confined inside, so you don't have to go out and do location shooting, which was expensive for the BBC at that time. And this structure still recurs in Doctor Who today, like in all of the post-revival seasons. There's at least one of these, and sometimes even two. Other examples would be the Stone Tape. A Nigel Neal television play is all about finding a ghost manifestation, but the people showing up are like acoustical scientists and stuff, and so they're trying to... There's the juxtaposition of, we are scientists, we master our universe, we're investigating things, we're learning what's going on, and there's a horror. And even the last of the original Romero zombie trilogy, Day of the Dead, is also an installation horror piece because it's set in an underground.
And you could argue, speaking of movies that John Carpenter remade, Stone Tape did not straight up become Prince of Darkness, but there is a lot of Stone Tape DNA in Prince of Darkness, which again is not a scientific installation. It's a church with a mysterious artifact, but then scientists come to the church, as in the Stone Tape, and examine the mysterious artifact with all of their cutting-edge 80s gimmickry and gadgetry. And of course, they are under siege by the sort of flocks of street people that are activated by Satan in a jar. And then the enemy within, Satan in a jar, begins to turn them and poison them, just as in The Thing, the alien does to the folks there. A sort of side of, you know, if you're talking about scientists going to places and bad things happening to them, even before John Campbell's Who Goes There, speaking of Antarctica, we have the archaeological horror of Mountains of Madness, 1931, H.P. Lovecraft, which provides a huge amount of the footprint for Alien, Ridley Scott, which begins as installation horror. We go to this horrific dead spaceport on a planet, and then it becomes a installation, if by installation you mean a spaceship, that is invaded, the base under siege, except it's the Nostromo, and it's under siege from within by the alien. And that is the model that takes, is sort of to take two different installation horrors and flip them in mirror images of each other. But it all comes back to At the Mountains of Madness, which again is something that Campbell read before writing Who Goes There, although the question of direct influence is unanswerable, I think, at this point.
So our next question then is, how do we do this in our games? And so the essential ingredients, I think, are confined space. It's not just if you're going to have it in a church in the middle of the city where a science team has shown up, you've also got to add an additional confining element. Like once you're in the church, you're not going to get out. And also the fact that we're juxtaposing the known versus the unknown, the scientific method versus the depths of horror. And of course, that's, you know, straight out of Frankenstein. That is foundational to the horror genre and to the science fiction genre. And also that you have a group of people working together and there are tensions emerge between them and their different personalities start to determine how well they deal with this, who winds up the next victim of the creature, who tries to make a deal with it, who reveals a weird secret that may or may not be useful, and ultimately, who are the survivors at the end. And so you, in order to create a scenario of this, you create your installation, you define the cast of characters. And so the next question is this a one-shot, or do you expect the characters to survive later? And so if you're doing it as a one-shot, you still, I think, want to have a cast of Game Master characters who are going to be the first ones to be picked off by whatever the horror is, because otherwise people are going to be bounced out of the table pretty quick.
Yeah.
If, you know, if you're killed in 20 minutes in, spoiler GMs, that's not fun. And so you can build the relationships between the Game Master characters and their different extreme responses to what's going on that in different ways will all add to the obstacles. And you may also want to build in reasons for the player characters to care about and want to protect those people and therefore to be horrified when they are destroyed by the horrific force, or to be motivated to protect them. So not only is necessarily someone, you know, this person is rash or sort of a jarhead, or this person is going to, because they're a coward, betray everybody. I think it's just as much fun to have the player characters realize, you know, moments before they happen that these things are going to happen, to set them up. And so it might even be useful in sort of the slow build as the horror is first introduced, as the moments of worry start to happen, also, you know, establish the conflicts and personalities between these characters in order that you care about them and know about them well enough to possibly predict what they're going to do and go wrong and stop them.
Another variant on that is that if you've got the first bunch of people that are taken out by the horror, and this could be, you know, like Lake's crew from Mountains of Madness, they showed up before Pabity got there and they got eaten by elder things and sawed up. You could run that with not GMCs, but with a even more one-shot group of PCs. You hand them out, you say, you are the guys who are at this research station when something has gone wrong. You're in the castle trying to figure out this weird phenomenon. You're, you know, whatever the installation is installed, you are the guys who were there. You are going to be the people whose mysterious video diary is found by the actual PCs. We're going to speed run your destruction. That sets up some terror and some horror. It gives some clues they can leave to themselves. And then it also tells the players, oh, this is real horror. This is scary. We could die. And then they feel that in their bones. And as the same thing starts happening again, you have the advantage of that pre-built tension. And that can work really, really well. I've done it in Knights Black Agents before, and it can be great fun. And that way, if one of your old first scene PCs survives, great. Then they become a GMC that you have a gigantic connection to because you played him for the first act of the show. And so now you definitely don't want anything to happen to your poor little guy who you extricated from the Cybermen or whatever in the early thing, because he worked very hard to not be chomped, and it's going to be terrifying and awful if, nope, he's the only guy who can go down into the generator and turn the lights back on, and we all know what's down there in the generator room, more Cybermen or ghosts or cyber ghosts, the worst kind of thing.
Another thing to establish as you're designing the scenario is, what is the central mystery of the scenario? And it can be simply, how do we get out?
Yeah.
And the point there, of course, is not even to try to survive the horrors. They're too powerful. You just want to find a way to counteract whatever force it is that's keeping you there. The other possibility is, what about the installation has caused the horror to arise? So that could be, this is an installation that's been here for a while. We've been to collect alien life forms on this planet. Guess what? One of the alien life forms has escaped, or they've hybridized, or whatever. And if the enemy, the force, whatever it is completely unrelated to the installation, they just happen to arrive and see you as easy pickings, right? This is just where their life raft dropped, or this is where the ice you melted has freed them, whatever that is. Then the mystery is, how do we use the resources that we have in the installation in order to find a way to defeat them? And so in that version, that's the classic one, where every attack by the creature leaves a clue to eventually allow you to come up with the special means of dispatch, the way of destroying them, to realize that you need
to. Turns out their weakness is flamethrowers.
Yes.
That's so many weaknesses. So many creatures have that as their weakness.
Right. But that's not a big mystery, right? So in that case, the mystery is, where did we leave the flamethrower?
And how can we get to the flamethrower, and who sabotaged the flamethrower is the creature among us even now?
Right. Because that's the big difference between the two versions of the thing, is the first one follows Howard Hawks's template of a group of people in a dangerous situation and their relationships. And the second one introduces the element of paranoia, in that any one of the people could also have been infected by the creature. And that introduces a sort of a theme of parasitism or transformation that we see in a lot of installation horror pieces that follow the John Carpenter thing.
Well, before we are trapped in this segment, turning on each other, possibly impelled by cyber ghosts, it behooves us to fire up the old flamethrower and burn away to the next ad, and possibly into the next hut or segment.
The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once more to wend our way up the creakety cobweb stairs. We're going to find on the landing the portrait of the fire salamander, and he's our favorite elemental. He's going to wave at us because it's a magic painting. We're going to wave back at him just because we're polite and head on in to the parlor of the consulting occultist. And this time around, the consulting occultist over the years has told us about many Elizabethan magicians, but until today, you haven't heard him talk about Simon Forman, oft arrested, a hanger-on in various scenes, including the theater scene, and he has a exciting, long story to get to. So, Ken, why don't you start his tale?
Yeah, he's born in 1552 in Quidhampton, which I am assured is in a parish named Fulston St. Peter. And you say, what's so funny about Fulston? And the answer is, it's spelled Fuggleston St. Peter, which you ask, why does he want to leave town? There we are. He has to write that next to his name whenever he signs anything. Anyway, it's by Salisbury in Wiltshire. His father used to work for the abbey that became Wilton Park, and probably a recusant Catholic. He was a page to Baroness Willoughby, who was another Catholic noble. She loses her power, and I think her head, certainly her power, with the passing of Catherine of Aragon, her big patron. And then his father is denied an inheritance and dies mad in 1563. Simon's mother immediately takes him out of the free grammar school and makes him do menial work. He's the fifth of eight children, so she's got lots of mouths to feed. He doesn't like any of that. He figures that he's, you know, marked out for better things. He apprentices himself to a local merchant named Matthew Common. That is all right, but he gets in a lot of fights with Mrs. Common. I think she probably has opinions about how much work the apprentice should do. This is too early for the other reason he gets into fights with ladies in his life. But in 1573, he is so desperate to get out of town that he goes to Oxford as the servant of two Salisbury gentlemen's sons. And he gets a smattering of knowledge in Oxford while in between being their servant and go-between and letter carrier to the girls they're trying to date. He spends 4 years after that as a school teacher, a tutor, an adjunct, anything that gets him around education, lets him read more books. He'll take a job like that. He meets a physician, herbalist, astrologer, and necromancer named Francis Cox in Wiltshire and learns all of those arts from him. It's the only book that he keeps his whole life is Cox's Book of Medicine. And in 1579, he feels like he's learned enough and sets himself up with his own shingle as a physician and astrologer in Salisbury, in the big city. He has the first then of several prophetic visions, and we know that he's always been a vivid dreamer because we have his diary that goes up to the year 1602 in which he talks about his dreams. He talks about his whole life, and that's why we have so much detail about Forman. And he also learns to command spirits in 1579. And shortly after maybe telling one too many people about his spirit commanding powers, he is arrested and imprisoned for magic. And that's in June of 1579. Also, he's practicing medicine without a degree, which is illegal, at least in a big city. And his books are all confiscated, and he's very mad about that. He appeals to the Privy Council, which is not something that everyone thinks to do, but that's that Oxford learning. And he's released in July of 1580. And his biographer, A.L. Rowse, speculates that what has happened is that the people who are arresting him all the time in Salisbury have enemies at court. And those enemies are just messing with them by getting Simon Forman released. And he's not even an afterthought to them. It's really more a way to put a finger in the eye of their enemies in town.
Right. It's like, if these jerks don't like you, we do like you.
We do like you.
Welcome to freedom.
So he moves to London, sets up as a physician there. He meets a guy who says, you're such a good physician, I want you in my household. They go to Holland, and in Holland, he studies more medicine and magic because it's a great place to do that. He says, I've got three kinds of big city learning now. I'm going to go back to Quidhampton and restart my medical practice, plus some tutoring on the side. And then I can carry messages to London. I can travel all over the area, and I'll be an itinerant doctor and magician, and I'll pick up books where I can.
Right. And he's taking care of that unlicensed thing by doing some learning in The Hague.
Right. And in 1582, he is briefly captured by pirates at Studland in Dorset. That's also the year that he gets his first mistress. He's very excited about that in his diary. In 1584, he is jailed in London. He spends July in jail. 1585, he's sued over a medical bill back in Salisbury by a Mrs. Samways. Mrs. Common, who still hates him, shows up to say he's always been a bad lot, and I think he's a magician. Did we all forget that he was a magician? Then the Samways boys beat him up. He's found liable for the money, and his big defense of why he should get the money, I cured your leg, Mrs. Samways. Everyone says, well, you don't have a medical degree. The only way you possibly could have cured her leg is with black magic. Back to prison for you. So,
oh, we just had one of those Hague medical degrees. It doesn't count in England.
Right, doesn't count. So in 1586, once more, his increasingly irritated at Salisbury politics patrons get him out of jail. In 1587, he's arrested again, and this time for having a magic book in church. And once more, his library is confiscated, and they have to take his library to someone to study it and see if it's full of black magic. And he says, oh, all the black magic books, those aren't mine. I was keeping them for someone. And also, the marginal notes in the regular books about how to do black magic, that's not in my handwriting. I can show you. And I was like, you're a doctor. You have terrible handwriting. But once more, the Privy Council lets him out. He says, all right, I'm going to do a John Dee. I'm going to get a medium. And he gets a man named John Goodridge, who has been gelded for some reason. And so that's a moment. But it's also in 1587, and maybe John Goodridge points him to him, but he meets and befriends Sir George Carey, Lord Hunsdon, and he's the governor of the Isle of Wight, which is where he would have met him. And he doctors Carey's daughter, Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is the first of his noble patients to address him in her letters as father. And that brings up the fact that you should not trust Simon Forman alone with your female patients, I think is maybe the way that I would just put that, and then we move on. But Elizabeth Carey is also the patron of Shakespeare's company, so this is probably where he gets into play going, and she's also the patron of the School of Night, if you're using that wonderful gumshoe game. There we go.
And remind people what the School of Night is.
The School of Night is the quote-unquote school of atheism that surrounded Sir Walter Raleigh and was a bunch of people, poets mostly, but also mathematicians, scholars of all kind, who studied magic. And did they do it for evil purposes? Who can say? Shakespeare was not a member, but he knew a bunch of people that were, including almost certainly our buddy Christopher Marlowe. So that's what's going on with that. So Forman has now definitely gotten into the theatrical world, as well as the espionage world and the magic world, if he wants it. And sure enough, 1588, he feels good enough with all of his new knowledge to practice necromancy himself. Again, writes this in his diary. This is a document that I can't believe he's writing down, taking notes on the criminal conspiracy, as they say. 1589, he's drafted to serve in the Portugal expedition. This is the Counter Armada. And he says, this is clearly doomed. As a prophet, I know this. And so he gets himself thrown in jail in Southampton. And so when the fleet leaves, he's out of his draft. He moves back to London.
Well, I'm glad all of his points in being jailed finally paid off for him.
Right. 1590, he is brought before the Star Chamber, accused of shifty practice, because one of the things that he would do, because he was literate, is he would interpret contracts for people. And they would say, this is a contract. I don't know what it says. Should I sign it? And he would read it to them and tell them what it means and say, sign it or don't sign it. And one of the ladies that paid him to read the contract said he was also being paid by the guy who wrote the contract, and it was a trick. And so he was, you know, given a stern talking to over that, writes his own book on necromancy, which he keeps in his library, does not publish it, continues his combo of astrology, physicianing, and prophetic visions. And according to his diary, people start coming to him with, am I going to find love? Where are my bracelets? Who stole the cat? You know, so he's also sort of a private detective in a wild way. And he does a lot of these sorts of adventures. These are sort of his bread and butter as well. His big year for him is 1592, because that's the plague year. And all the doctors in London run away. And Simon Forman stays in London to treat the poor. I assume he also stays in London to treat the middle class, but he definitely treats the poor. He catches the plague himself, but he cures himself with strong water. Further deponent saith not. In 1594, the College of Physicians comes back to London, and Simon Forman says, "Oh, look who it is, Mr. No Help During the Plague." Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. No Help During the Plague.
Let me antagonize the College of Physicians, I who do not strictly have a medical license.
Right. And so they begin a series of prosecutions, 1594, 1595, 1596, 1598, 1601, of Forman for practicing medicine illegally. And they haul him up and they say, "You're practicing medicine illegally." And he says, "Better than you." And they say, "That's a 20-pound fine." And he says, "Take it. I got more where that came from." And he also, I guess because he keeps getting fined, he says, "I need to get the Philosopher's Stone." And his version of the Philosopher's Stone, again, what a wonderful diary this is. He called it Keiko, which I feel like he's going to market the Philosopher's Stone. Turn lead to cake or to gold with Keiko. In 1597, he's getting sick of the College of Physicians coming around all the time, so he moves to Lambeth, which would put him under the direct jurisdiction of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And that slows the College of Physicians' roll down somewhat, but they figure, you know, loopholes. He keeps coming back into London to go to plays. And in 1597, he is also consulted by a Mrs. Mountjoy, who is also known as Shakespeare's landlady, and by Amelia Lanier, who is a poet and the mistress of the first Lord Hunsdon, so the dad of his buddy George Hunsdon, and who, according to A.L. Rowse, is the dark lady of the sonnets and is certainly in the Southampton circle. So Shakespeare would have known her even if she isn't the dark lady. So again, we have a connection between Simon Forman and the Earl of Southampton and all manner of stuff going on. In 1598, the niece of Sir Robert Cecil from episode 635.
Or Cecil, as right. I just heard everyone in the UK yell into their podcast device.
Yeah, well, anyway. And by Lady Frances Howard, the neglected and, in fairness, completely uninterested wife of the Earl of Essex. And she also becomes one of his quote-unquote daughters, refers to Forman as her father for many years thereafter. And it only takes so many daughters who are in powerful roles in the court before you become immune to petty concerns about what the College of Physicians thinks. In 1599, he marries a 17-year-old girl named Jane Ann Baker, and she has aristocratic connections in Kent and is also connected to Canterbury. This is part of that shoring up the Archbishop of Canterbury, who at some point must have been asking, "What have I let myself in for?" In 1603, though, these connections pay off because he gets a medical degree from Cambridge, and he's officially allowed to practice medicine, and no one can say boo to him. This is where his diary stops, so we don't have as much information. He has little jottings and daybook notes and things, and one of them is what he calls his Book of Plays, where he writes down four plays that he saw, including Macbeth at the Globe in 1610, Winter's Tale and Cymbeline in 1611, and someone else's play of Richard II, because he describes the plot and it doesn't match Shakespeare's plot. So it's a different Richard II play, but it's still pretty interesting. He's apparently been Mr. First Knight for a long old time, maybe, as I say, all the way back to 1592 or 1597, maybe as far back as 1587. So he doesn't write everybody that he knows. He just writes down people that he's medically consulting with, or gossip if he hears really good gossip, which will come up. Also in 1611, he and his wife are having a fun little marital discussion about which of them will bury the other one. And Simon Forman says to his wife, "Don't worry, Tronco." Tronco is his little pet name for his wife. He says, "Don't worry, Tronco, you'll bury me, but you'll have to dig me back up." And she says, "I hate being married to a prophet." And 4 days later, sure enough, he dies of a burst abscess, according to Rowse, or according to him, an impost. He's rowing across the Thames and, you know, pop, some pops and he dies. He leaves an estate of £1,200, which is very good for a poor boy from Quidhampton, and one legitimate son named Clement, and God knows how many byblows. He leaves his books to a guy named Dr. Napier of Linford, and from there they pass into the Ashmolean, which is why we have his diary, because Dr. Napier got bought out by Elias Ashmole. So you'd think, no problem. Ha ha. he's well out of everything. But in 1615, Lady Frances Howard, his old client, and a lady named Mrs. Anne Turner are tried for poisoning Sir Thomas Overbury in 1613. Lady Frances's lengthy relationship with Forman comes up at the trial, and everyone denounces Forman as having worked diabolical love magic to get Frances the love of the younger Earl of Southampton. This, I think, is the fifth Earl. Overbury opposed the match, and that's why he had to die. And Jane Forman, sure enough, just according to the prophecy, had to dig up her husband in the sense that she testifies against Turner and Howard, turns state's evidence, provides magical poppets to the court. This is the kind of thing my husband made, and they were made of wax, but they somehow survived for 5 years after his death. And also a document by Forman, quote, signifying what ladies loved what lords in the court. And she turns that over, says this is the kind of thing he's up to. The judge opens the document and, according to Rouse, sees his wife's name at the top of the document, shuts the document, and refuses to read it out in court. So the judge then condemns Forman as a child of the devil. And that, of course, has posthumously blackened his reputation. But I'm sure Simon Forman didn't care. He was a poor kid from Quidhampton with a apparently very weird-looking head, according to his portrait. But he had lots of lady friends and £1,200 at his death, and eventually a real honest-to-God medical degree. So, and he got to see Shakespeare play Macbeth, you know, on stage. So who's the loser? Not Simon Forman, I say.
Right. If everybody heard the bit earlier about him becoming a private detective and wondered why no one has done anything with it, that's because someone has.
Yeah.
The late author Judith Cook wrote 5 books from 1997 to 2000 featuring Forman as the detective in a series of Elizabethan mysteries. And if you have a Elizabethan campaign with different notables around, someone could play him as a player character. And of course, I'm sure he's bursting with information that the player characters could get out of him. And all they have to do is find what prison he's in and possibly slip some money to the Privy Council in order to pay back whatever bit of information or book that he's pointed them to.
Yeah, he certainly is a resource for a campaign, as you suggest. He could be a player character even in a School of Night game. And if, in fact, the considered judgment of the British Crown is correct and he was a son of the devil, well, he can be a bad guy because he does have necromancy powers. He's got influence all through court. He can't be pinned down because he's got the Archbishop of Canterbury under his thumb. He'd make a great sort of a mastermind. And perhaps Keiko, the delicious crumbly version of the Philosopher's Stone, is a kind of a thing that you need to get your hands on for your own adventures. And he's certainly not letting you have Keiko. And so even if he doesn't begin mad at you when you bust into his Lambeth house to steal his Keiko, then he turns the power of necromancy against you. And that would be great fun all by itself, I think.
It might even turn out that his prediction about his wife having to dig him up was non-metaphorical, and that he's walking around after 1611 as a revenant or as a lich or something.
Right. If there's rumors of a lich who pinches your butt if you turn around, then that's probably Simon Forman, and you should maybe avoid that part of Lambeth, I would say.
Well, now that we know to avoid Lambeth, I think we've told everybody everything they need to know about the four topics of this episode. But guess what? We'll be back with another episode and another four topics a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep horrors out of this podcast installation alongside such backers as
Helly Fisher,
Robert Dean,
Brian K. Eason,
Chihiro Yamada,
and Garrett Fitzgerald.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.